Hi, this is Sedge Thompson. Welcome to this special audio highlights podcast from West Coast Live. For more information about our shows and other guests and podcasts, wcl.org. My next guest on West Coast Live is an astronomer and author. He is a research scientist at the Carnegie Institution of Washington's Department of Terrestrial Magnetism. He's a fellow of the American Geophysical Union and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And he's written a number of books, some of them a little more technical than his current one here, which is called The Crowded Universe, The Search for Living Planets. And it's about what has led up to the Kepler mission, which was launched just this week and is now in outer space looking for signs of other Earths. Please welcome Alan Boss. How do you do? Let's move forward a little bit here. Thank you very much for being here. You must be, you would not have done well as an astronaut, one of those tiny capsules.
I actually applied to be an astronaut. I was a postdoc at NASA Ames Research Center in 1979, and I found a form in my mailbox one day saying, you can apply to be an astronaut. I applied. They said, yeah, you look good. They sent back the next form saying how tall you are. End of the road. one spacesuit fits all.
So what's the average height of an astronaut?
Short.
Yeah. All right. But nowadays, I mean, couldn't they make a capsule just a little bit bigger?
They could, but it really makes sense to just have one sort of standard size so that everyone fits in. You want the smallest person who doesn't eat so many shrimp cocktails. Yeah.
And then if somebody's suit needs to be replaced, I mean, you just give them the same thing.
You can just trade suits up there. You know, if you get a dirty bottom, you just switch off with somebody else's.
How big is this spacecraft, this Kepler? It's like what? It's like an eyeball that's up in space, an electronic eyeball that's been sent up. And in terms of camera pixels, you know, you may have, 10 pixels in your camera. So this is, 93 million pixels in it?
Yes, about 95 megapixels, John. In fact, it's worse than an eyeball. It's an eyeball that can never shut. Kepler has a dust cover, which will be blown off in about a week or two. And once it's shut off, it can never close its eyes. So it's sort of like, if you remember that horrible scene in Clockwork Orange when Malcolm McDowell has his eyeballs plucked open. It's sort of like that. For 3.5 years, Kepler will be like Malcolm McDowell.
But what it's going to be looking at is not movie stars or cameras. It's going to be looking for objects that will be transiting across stars, which might suggest that it's a planet.
Exactly. Kepler is going to be staring at initially about 170,000 stars in the constellations of Cygnus and Lyra, looking for the transitory little dimmings of the star when a planet just happens to have its orbit aligned such that the planet passes in front of the star every time it orbits around the star. So if we're looking for Earth-like planets, you're looking for a dimming that's caused by an object 100 times smaller than the star, which means the dimming is only a part in 10,000, a very tiny dimming. In the case of an Earth, it happens once a year. So you see a dimming by a tiny fraction, part in 10,000. You have to wait a year, see if it dims again. Then you think, now I've got a period. Let's see if it happens a third time. Happens a third time, you say, I almost believe it. Let's watch for a fourth time. Happens the fourth time, you call up science or nature and say, I want to write a paper.
And then your name is known as somebody who's found a possible Earth elsewhere. I did not know. I'd always assumed that all of the planets of the solar system revolved around the sun. I was shocked to find that's not so. That in fact even the sun is orbiting, and there's actually a different center to the solar system than the sun.
That's exactly right, because even as the sun pulls on the planets, makes them go in a circle, the same thing happens with the planets on the sun. The planets pull on the sun, in the case of our Jupiter, makes the sun orbit around a little circle roughly equal to the sun's own diameter. So every 12 years, the sun goes through a little circle on the sky equal to its own diameter. And if you could look at the sun from a nearby star, you could actually measure that change in position. You can also measure the change in velocity. It also means that the sun is moving either towards you at 30 miles per hour for part of those 12 years or away from you at 30 miles per hour for those 12 years. So you could actually measure it from a nearby star.
Is this what's meant when a star wobbles?
Exactly. That's the wobble. And if you measure the velocity change, this plus or minus 30 miles per hour, that's measured by something called the Doppler shift, something that an Austrian physicist proposed back in 1842. It works for sound waves. It's the same thing that happens when you hear a siren coming at you at high frequency as it's coming towards you and lower frequency as it goes away. Same thing happens to light, because light and sound are both wave phenomena. So the waves get stretched, redshifted or blue-shifted. And if you use that technique, that's actually how we found the bulk of the planets which are known outside the solar system. There's something like 330 planets known outside the solar system. About 300 of them have been found by this Doppler shift technique.
And so if there's a star that's wobbling, does that mean then that there are then planets going around it?
Absolutely, because astronomers have tried to figure out if there's any other way to explain a wobble, and there really is no other physical explanation for it. When you see a velocity shift like that or see a positional wobble on the sky, their only explanation is there's got to be something else in the system. By measuring the amplitude of the shift, you can see how massive the object has to be that's causing the wobble, and these typically turn out to be objects with roughly a mass of Jupiter. So we've already seen something like a 250 or so Jupiter mass objects, and we're now in the process of trying to find Earth-like objects.
And so there's something called the habitable field. What is the habitable field?
Well, it's
often habitable belt.
A habitable zone. It's basically the distances around a star where you could have liquid water on the surface. So we're sort of looking for Earth analogs. There might very well be other sorts of planets and satellites where life could exist, but at the very least, we want to find something which is pretty close to the Earth. And so we know that water is essential for life on our planet, and so the basic mission of the Kepler mission is to find other roughly Earth-mass planets which are orbiting at a distance from their star, pretty close to Earth's distance from the Sun, for example, where they could have liquid water, and therefore we'll know how many habitable worlds there are in the universe.
So the physicist Enrico Fermi said, okay, where are they? Where are other signs of intelligent life? Why haven't we heard from them? Some people who say that there is intelligent life already here and has shown up in UFOs and so forth say they've just found us too dull and don't want to communicate with us, for instance.
Yeah, well, I'm waiting to be abducted because I think there'll be a good book on that. Hasn't happened yet.
What would you, if you were abducted, what would be some of your first questions? What would you want to know?
I'd mostly want to know how in the hell you got here, because it's pretty hard to get to Earth from another star. We really can't beat the speed of light. That's the problem. The speed of light is so immense that at the speed of our fastest spacecraft that we can fire off right now, it would take us 100,000 years to get to the closest star. So in reality, even though there might very well be other civilizations in the galaxy, we can't really get to them. They can't get to us. The best we can do is send a signal to each other by radio.
And 100,000 years is what? Is it sort of twice the time of expected sort of human existence on this Earth? I mean, to date? 50,000 years of human development?
Depending on which anthropologist you talk to, we have human beings have been around for maybe 160,000 to 200,000 years. So, yeah, 100,000 years is basically we will have evolved into something else by the time we get someone that comes back to us from the closest star.
And a civilization could have come and gone in another planet, and we wouldn't know about it by the time we have any sign of it even.
That's another major problem, is that even though there are probably other intelligent civilizations in the galaxy, they're probably out of phase with us. They may have actually formed and did their thing a billion years ago, or they may be waiting for another billion years before they come and go. And who knows how long we have to live ourselves. I mean, we certainly are good for probably a couple thousand years, you know, maybe 10,000 years, you know, 100,000 years is pushing it, but you're really talking about billions of years. I mean, how many bagels do you want to eat, right?
Yeah. You'd hope that the bagel might evolve, too. I don't know, you know, in some way. So once you find an Earth-like object, an Earth-like planet, one that's in the habitable zone that may have water, what next?
Well, when Kepler tells us how frequently Earths are, and I think it's going to be basically that every sun-like star has an Earth-like planet. We already know enough from other surveys to make that guess. It's going to tell us, though, is it 100%, is it 90%, is it 50%? We'll then know how to take the next steps to build another space telescope, which will be able to search our solar neighborhood. The planets that Kepler finds will be pretty far away. They'll sort of be on the other side of the city. We want to look on the planets on our neighborhood. We want to know which houses on our block have life. And then we're going to want to see if the lights run in those houses. And we want to take the next step to see which houses are lit up, which really have life on them. And that'll be another sort of telescope that NASA will want to build. And the key design feature for that is knowing how far do we have to look. Do we have to go 3 houses down the block? Do we have to go 10 houses down the block? And Kepler will tell us how far down the block we need to go to find another habitable world which might have life.
Do you think that Kepler himself would have imagined such a voyage?
One would hope so. He actually had a little bit of a checkered history. He's known for his discovery of the Doppler effect, but he was also at one point the administrator for the university in Vienna, and there was a young man named Gregor Mendel who came in and applied to become a physicist. And unfortunately, Kepler felt that his mathematical credentials were not sufficient, and so Mendel went on to do something else. He dabbled in genetics, one might say, to the everlasting benefit of mankind. And so this is a nice blend of Kepler's orbital laws with what's now called astrobiology, looking for life elsewhere, which I think Mendel has a lot to say about.
So when you define life on another planet, it could be bacteria level, it could be anything that would, produces methane, which you point out in the book, largely on this planet comes from cows?
Well, it actually comes from methanogenic bacteria, which inhabit the guts of cows, as well as rice paddies and swamps and things. So if we actually can find some nearby worlds, and we're checking to see if the lights are on in the house, as it were, what we'll probably find in the atmospheres of those planets are hopefully evidence for oxygen or ozone. Oxygen is produced on our planet primarily by photosynthesis, by things like cyanobacteria, blue-green algae. And we'll also hope to find methane as well, which, as I just said, comes from methanogenic bacteria.
So it might mean there are cows on other planets.
Not only that, cows that eat grass.
Which implies other things, lawnmowers.
Lawnmowers and butter for your bagels.
Was there any kind of a strange, what kind of political machinations went on to get this space launch, or was it an easy road?
It's an endless battle to get a space mission launched. Anytime NASA decides to try to put together some money for a mission, there are usually 20, 30 competing concepts, and maybe two of them are selected for further study, and one of them eventually is perhaps selected to fly. But even once it's approved for flight and they begin developing it, it can very well face what's called a cancellation review, where they decided, well, gee, something's not going right, you're spending too much money, we're going to cancel you. Kepler itself went through one of those near-death experiences just a few years ago, but thankfully survived. So it's quite a struggle to get a mission going. The principal investigator of Kepler, Bill Borucki, has been working on this since 1984, if you can believe it. He's been working for basically 25 years. And so we've jokingly said perhaps NASA wanted to delay his mission until 2009 so we could hit the 25th anniversary.
But 2009 is also the 400th anniversary of many other events this year.
Yes, of Galileo and his telescope, and 150th anniversary of Charles Darwin's publication of the Evolution of Species, and the 200th anniversary of Charles Darwin's birth. So it's also International Year of Astronomy as well. So it's a great year for Kepler to take off.
There's an acronym, a lot of acronyms in science. Can you explain Kiss My Lips, Tootsie?
Yeah, not all astronomers like that, but that's actually the acronym that's used to remember the otherwise obscure sequence of letters that are used to describe the different stellar types. The most massive stars are O stars. Then going down the line, they're B. I got to use the acronym myself. Remember it: O B A F G K M. And recently, they decided they're even lower mass stars, so-called L's and T's. So it used to be just kind of, the acronym was stood for O-Beifying Girl, Kiss Me, and I added on, well, O-Beifying Girl, Kiss My Lips, Tootsie. But there are other variations of that. Some female astronomers don't particularly care for that line, but we'll see if they can come up with a better one.
What is the one, is it Corot, as in the painter? How do you pronounce that? C-O-R-O-T.
Yes.
Convection, Rotation, and Planetary Transits.
Yeah, the French decided to try to steal a step on Kepler. They launched their own competing mission to try to find planets by transits just a little over 2 years ago. Their spacecraft, however, is nowhere as near as capable as Kepler's spacecraft. And so even though it has a two-year head start, Kepler in the end is going to do the best job of finding Earth-like planets, and particularly because Kepler is designed specifically to do nothing but find Earths.
And it won't take pretty pictures like Hubble.
They will be pictures, but they actually will be purposely blurred, because what Kepler really wants to do is to look at how bright the stars. Remember, we're looking for this very tiny dimming of a part in 10,000. So rather than having a nice sharp picture, you actually want to blur out the light from the star over several pixels, the little elements of your digital camera, and count all the photons that hit on each single pixel and never miss a single photon. And to do that, you sort of make it purposely blurry. So the pictures will look sort of fantastic if you have glaucoma, I suppose, but to other folks, they'll be really useful for finding planets. They won't be quite as gorgeous as the things we're expecting. We've always gotten from Hubble.
What do you wear when you go to an observatory at night?
Long pants.
Long underwear, parkas?
No, actually, astronomers are pretty have it easy these days. They sit inside a heated or air-conditioned dome at night. The main problem is you sometimes don't want your dome where you're sitting to be a different temperature from the telescope is, because the differences in temperatures can cause what's called dome seeing, thermal effects inside the dome. So if the telescope's kind of cold, you might be a little bit cold too. But so you dress warm, but you're at least protected from the wind and the night. So compared to the old days, which are maybe 50 years ago, when people actually had to sit inside the telescope unprotected from the elements pretty much, it's quite plush in comparison.
How often do you go out and look through a telescope yourself? Do you have one in your backyard?
No, I'm actually a theoretical astrophysicist. I've only 6 years ago pretended to become an astronomer. And so I've begun using a telescope without ever having any real training in it. But my colleagues at Carnegie have allowed me to do that. They humor me, at least. And so I've been traveling down to Chile about 3 or 4 times a year for the last 6 years, spending a week at a time down there, because I have my own ground-based planet search effort where we're actually trying to see that wobble of the star on the sky, the positional wobble, not in Doppler space, but the positional wobble, which does involve taking lots of pictures over and over again and trying to see if you can see the wobble in space, implying that that star has a planet.
How helpful is a computer then in trying to see this wobble? I mean, does it put together a sequence of images like a film?
It's sort of like that, except you reduce the data into not simply images for comparison, but you compare the distances between your target star and the other stars on your image to try to look for relative motion. You have to have a sort of a background reference frame, and so you're comparing your target star, which is close by, which is wobbling, with much more distant stars, which hopefully are not wobbling much at all because they're much farther away. So you're comparing distances that you're measuring on your images from all the different stars, and it has to be analyzed by computers because, of course, there are lots of effects you have to take care of in the data analysis. And so it's not simply a question of putting together an image and watching the star wobble in space. You will, in the end, get what would be basically a graph of the motion of the star in two dimensions, which astronomers use call right ascension and declination. That's basically X and Y on the sky. But for astronomical terms, it's RA and DEC. So we will see plots of a star wobbling in RA and DEC, and eventually we'll say, gee, it looks like it's got a planet.
What were your science fair projects when you were in high school?
Well, I actually grew up on an island in the Gulf of Mexico, and so I was planning on becoming an oceanographer, and so my projects had to do with tides in the ocean and things like that. I didn't really intend to become an astronomer, in part because in that part of Pinellas County, you really don't see much of sky. It's pretty much built up. There are lots of clouds, and so you're lucky to basically see the moon on a good night.
What island in the Gulf of Mexico?
Clearwater Beach, just by Tampa and St. Petersburg on the west coast.
So how far was that from mainland Florida?
It was about a half of a mile offshore. There's a causeway that links the two.
And would you go see rocket launches?
I actually went to see Apollo 16 take off in April of 1972. It was a spectacular launch, but we drove right to the east coast of Florida. This is on the west coast, so it's one of these things where back then the Apollo launches were really major cultural events. And so the entire U.S. Route 1 on the East Coast, just across the Indian River from Cape Kennedy, would be lined with cars. And this happened to be an early morning launch. So everyone camped on the side of the road. And then as soon as the rocket took off the next morning, spectacular Saturn V launch. You could hear feel the rumble in your body from these engines, even though they were 3 miles away. As soon as the rocket disappeared from sight, everyone jumped in their car and immediately filled up Route 1. It was sort of like the start at Le Mans. And so we went from nothing on the road at all to total gridlock. And several hours later, managed to get out of the area.
So there wasn't an opportunity at that speed then to hear much Doppler effect. Although I suppose if you had the sensitive instruments, you could hear the sound very, very, very slow movement of 2 mile per hour traffic.
You mostly just hear a real rumble, and the same thing happened last week with the launch of the Kepler satellite.
Oh, you're talking there about the rocket, yeah.
Yeah, it's the rocket rumble, right. You can't really, once the object is off, heading off in several miles up, you don't no longer hear any sound from that. It's just the initial burst of the booster, the first stage, basically, you hear within the first minute or so, and then it's soundless.
It must be thrilling, but what about the music that goes with it? I mean, in the right stuff and Apollo 13, there's always magnificent music that plays as the rockets rumble.
Yeah, I would go with the opening from Thus Sprach Zarathustra by Richard Wagner, that classic piece, beginning of 2001 Space Odyssey. That's the classic revealing of all truth and knowledge type thing.
If you traveled in space and somebody said, okay, Alan, you can time transport to one place elsewhere in the solar system, or even in the universe, where would you go? What kind of knowledge would you like to have?
Well, I would probably wait a few years before I made the choice, because I would want to see where Kepler finds some planets. And then I would probably want to go to one of those solar systems to see that planet, because we really would love to know what a habitable world looks like that is created around a different system from our own star. We have no idea what we're going to find. It's probably going to have some sort of, as we said before, slime, mold, or bacteria or something, maybe something more advanced. It'll be quite a surprise, because even just looking at the incredible variety of species on our own planet, you know, there are lots of little bugs and critters that if you see for the first time, as far as you know, that came from another planet. It'll be equally surprising. The life is going to evolve similarly. It probably will be carbon-based. It'll be, you can include water, but it could be
creatures that look like giraffes doing a radio show.
Possibly, yes. I don't know if they'll be wearing red shoes, but we can check to see.
Or would the light spectrums be the same? I mean, I guess the laws of physics would mean that the spectrums would be the same.
We certainly expect physics and chemistry to work in the same way. In fact, there's even some sense that the animals we find there, if we found multicellular life, will be somewhat similar to life. There's something called convergent evolution. For example, eyes have been developed independently by several different species on our planet. They've all evolved the same sort of eye that we have, even though they are not on the same evolutionary tree. So the same sort of design is sort of optimal for any life form. So to some extent, we can expect to find objects or animals which have, some of them will have four legs. There's no reason to have five, right? That's sort of redundant. Two is probably all you need for bipedalism. We don't expect to see things with three legs. We do expect to see other living creatures which have eyes similar to our own, because there are some things which really are seemingly optimal. On the other hand, other things like coloration and hair and scales and things, those will look quite different, I'm sure.
You look good in scales.
Well, thank you. I'm sure you would, too.
Alan Boss, The Crowded Universe, The Search for Living Planets. Fascinating, of course, and I'm kind of this, published by Basic Books. Thank you.